Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. ESG, or Environmental, Social, Governance, promises to help the bottom line and the planet at the same time. Is it too good to be true? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of an episode digging into that very question.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It wasn't easy for MSNBC anchor Katie Turr to bring her baby into the world. Emergency C-section, post-surgical infection, a postpartum psychiatric evaluation. But Turr says she was lucky. She had extended paid time off, but it opened her eyes to one form of American exceptionalism. Among industrialized nations, the U.S. stands alone in not having national paid parental leave. So when Turr got back to work, she had this message.
Parents need time with their babies. Babies need time with their parents. And moms need support. And if that support is coming from a partner, that partner should get equal time off. Paid time off. Emphasis on paid. Family leave supports babies, which supports us all.
In fact, there is increasing bipartisan support for the idea of parental leave. But when you ask Americans how to pay for it, that consensus falls apart. So this hour on Point, work, family, and paid parental leave. And you can join us. Would paid maternity or paternity leave had made a difference? Would it have made a difference in your life? Or do you object to the idea of a national plan to come up with a way to pay parents when they take leave? Join us anytime online at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And Katie Turr joins us today from New York. She is an anchor on MSNBC and a correspondent for NBC News as well. Katie Turr, welcome to On Point.
Good to see you, Meghna.
It's great to have you. First of all, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your experience after your son was born?
It's never easy giving birth. I want to preface it with that. And my situation, although difficult, is not unique in any way. I'm not the only one to have gone through this. I think a very high number of women have had a similar experience. In fact, I've heard from a lot of them since I wrote that essay the other day. I had almost no problems at all while I was pregnant. I think probably no problems. And I was induced a day before my due date at 39 weeks. And it quickly fell apart when I went into labor. I spiked a really high fever. I was in labor for 12 hours. And by the end of it, my fever had come back. My baby's heartbeat was spiking. And they pulled the plug and said, you have to get him out now. And I remember I was hysterical all the way from the labor room to the OR, crying my eyes out like I've never cried before, certainly never in front of my husband. And I was scared. You know, I was scared that I had waited too long. I was scared about the fever. I was hoping that my baby was going to be okay. And I was also terrified that in 2 minutes I was going to have a child that I have to take care of forever. And the C-section went fine. He came out. He immediately started crying. He was fine. But since I had an infection, they had to separate us for, I think it was 7 or 9 hours. And I remember that being extraordinarily difficult because I couldn't spend any time with my child immediately after birth. And I was not prepared for the pain and the recovery of a C-section.
Right.
I just did not fully understand what that meant. I think I assumed that since I had an easy pregnancy that I would have a vaginal delivery. I knew it was a tough recovery regardless, but the pain of being cut in your midsection and no longer having those muscles when you have to sit up to breastfeed immediately was an overwhelming experience. And you got to feed the baby every 2 hours. And since he was so small, he was 6 pounds, 4.5 ounces, that it was really important that he didn't lose too much of his birth weight, because if he did, then you know, he could potentially not survive. So the pressure to feed him and feed him immediately was extremely intense, and the milk doesn't come in immediately. You don't know this, and you're not prepared for what it's going to be like trying to figure out how they latch and wondering whether he's getting enough food. So the whole thing was scary. I'm a very chatty person. I'm a very bubbly person. And I remember those days in the hospital. I was almost catatonic.
Wow.
I was exhausted. I was overwhelmed. And I don't know what would have happened if I didn't have my husband by my side mm-hmm. the whole time.
Yeah. When you got home?
Yeah.
So that was just in the immediate
aftermath.
That was
just in the 4 days.
Right?
Yeah.
And then when you got home, at least you were at home and your husband was at home for a part of that time as well. I mean, how was that?
It was hard, you know, because you don't have the you don't have the motorized bed to help lift you up. So I was struggling to get out of bed. I suddenly wasn't hungry at all, so I wasn't eating as much as I should have, and I wasn't sleeping, and I really could barely move.
Yeah.
And I was terrified to look down at my scar, at my incision. It's just just the idea that I was cut in the middle and I didn't look down. And my husband said to me one day, "You're bleeding." And I thought like, oh, well, of course I'm bleeding. You know, that's what happens after birth. And it wasn't until the next day that I looked at the, they give these hospital mesh panties. And I looked down and I noticed that there was blood on them, but it was high. It was up toward the waistline. And I thought, oh, wait, no, I'm bleeding in my incision. And I called my doctor and I had a terrible experience with the doctor where like suddenly it was a holiday and there was literally nobody. It was a Friday and there was nobody in the office who could see me. And the only option they gave me was to go to the emergency room with my newborn baby.
Mm.
And I ended up calling an old doctor of mine and getting a sense from him about what to do. And I didn't end up going to the ER. But if I hadn't noticed that, my husband hadn't noticed it, it would have gotten a lot worse.
Right.
And I would have had to be rushed to the ER because something would have gone wrong. And then I would have been in the ER with my 5-day-old baby. It just – I needed his support in that time to keep me alive.
So let me ask you. Can you imagine having to go back to work in 2 weeks after that experience?
I cannot. And when I read the stats that 25% of women go back to work before 2 weeks, and there's a large number that go back within 10 days or within a week, it made me want to break down and cry. I can't imagine how difficult that would be. You need the baby. The baby needs you. Your brain isn't working. You've just gone through a joyful but traumatic experience. I just can't fathom it.
You got 5 months, though. Is that right?
4 months paid.
Okay.
I could take up to 6 months. 2 months not paid, so I ended up taking 5.
Okay. Is that standard for NBC?
It's relatively new. It's a Comcast standard.
Okay.
Bought NBC, that got put into place. And I mean, I'm grateful for the policy. The insurance is really good as well. It didn't cost me a ton of money to give birth. I was afraid that it was going to cost 50 grand because I kept hearing, you know, we do news stories about how much it costs to have a baby in this country, but it ended up not costing much at all because the insurance was so good. But again, I mean, I this should not just be available to me. This should be available to everybody. It's crazy that I'm among a privileged elite. This should be a foundational thing that mothers and fathers get across this country, because if you don't have healthy families or healthy babies, you don't have a healthy society.
Mm-hmm. Well, so let's talk about that. I mean, you the essay or your impassioned plea that you gave when you came back to work on MSNBC, you invited members of Congress or Ivanka Trump to come sit at the chair across from you and talk about efforts to get some kind of paid parental leave passed in the United States. Has anyone answered your invitation yet?
Yes, some Democratic lawmakers have answered my invitation to come on the show and talk about it. I had Congressman Jimmy Gomez the other day on talking about his experience and what he did to help expand the benefits in California for California's paid time off, because they have a policy. And I have heard from some other Democratic lawmakers who I'm trying to book as the days go by. I have not heard from any Republicans, although I know Marco Rubio mm-hmm. has a plan that Ivanka has, I think I've read, has worked with him at least or met with him about. I know that Joni Ernst has a plan as well. I'd love to talk to her. I don't think this should be a partisan issue. This is something that benefits everybody. And I know that there are plans on both sides of the aisle. So I really want to talk to everybody about it to find out what the best solution might be.
Well, we'll talk about Marco Rubio's plan a little more specifically in a few minutes. But Katie, I wonder what you think about this. There was a really interesting survey, the American Family Survey, that was a nationwide study of some 3,000 Americans done by Deseret News, the Center for the Study of Elections and Democracy at Brigham Young University, and it was conducted by YouGov. It's a fairly large study. They've been doing this for 5 years now, and their most recent survey found, as I mentioned at the very top of the show, there's increasing consensus in the United States, bipartisan consensus even, that some kind of family leave needs to be pushed forward here. But when you kind of break it down by the numbers, you find that, according to this survey, for example, that amongst regarding the question of should mothers at birth or the adoption of a child get paid family leave, 80% of Democrats said yes, 60% of independents said yes, and 53% of Republicans said yes. When it comes to the question of should fathers get some kind of leave, 72% of Democrats said yes, 52% of independents said yes, and 37% of Republicans said yes. So you see there's a fall off when it comes to what kind of parental leave we're talking about. I mean, what do you think about that?
I think it's interesting, and I do think it points to the values we have as a society, and also I think the mentality we have as a society that women are caretakers and men are breadwinners. I think it's an ingrained social order that we have had since for centuries now that bears out in our paid family leave policies, and I think it's misguided. I think that if you have women and men at home for the same amount of time or roughly the same amount of time when a baby is born, equality is born out of the family life, the responsibilities that each parents take over for each parents have for the baby. You have equality among the caregiving responsibilities. You have equality among the time that you go back to work so men aren't getting raises or promotions faster than women do. I think if you start there, then we'd have more equality across the board.
Well, we're talking this hour with Katie Turr. She is an anchor on MSNBC and an NBC News correspondent, and she spoke very passionately about parental leave in the United States. We'll hear more from Katie when we come back, plus a pediatrician in North Carolina as well. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. A recent episode featured a debate about ESG, or environmental social governance.
This sounds like more work than just putting your money into a social impact fund.
It's a lot more work.
Yeah.
Anybody who thinks there's an easy solution here is either engaged in puffery, greenwash, or deceiving themselves.
Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the episode.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about paid parental leave in the United States, or the absence of a national law about paid parental leave. Katie Turr joins us from New York. She is an anchor on MSNBC and an NBC News correspondent as well. And she just came back recently from an extended maternity leave. She had some challenges bringing her son into the world, and it opened her eyes. And she spoke very passionately about the need for parental leave in the United States. So she's sharing her story with us this hour. So let's go to Pat first, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Pat, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you, Meghna?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good. good. My fiance and I just had a baby 3 months ago. She just returned to work last week. New York State implemented a family leave benefit last year. She took 3 months off. I believe it was extremely necessary and beneficial, especially in recovery time. We almost had the baby in the car on the way to the hospital. The recovery time was awful for her, and she was thankful to have the paid family leave. It just took forever for the disability benefits to kick in. So that 6 week waiting period between having the baby and receiving those benefits was a little bit difficult of a time. But me as a father, I'm also entitled to those benefits. I'm going to take those around Christmas time, 8 weeks out of 10 that I'm allowed to spend that time to bond with my son as well. So I love the idea. I think it should be for everyone.
Well, Pat, thank you for your call. Let's get another call here. Let's go to Samantha, who's calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Samantha, you're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi, Samantha. Go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to call in and just kind of agree with everything your guest is saying. My wife and I recently brought our first child into the world. She was the birth parent, and I am the supportive partner. But I get as much leave as any, father or, non-birthing parent. So I only got 2 weeks of paid leave from my company. One whole week was completely spent in the hospital. So that wiped out 1 week. And then the next week, we were just having to force, this time, this constricted time to kind of bring this child into our home and kind of get used to a rhythm and a schedule just to kind of get to know our child. And then I'm back at work the following week. And there's absolutely not enough time for the both of us. And it just took a little while for my wife to get accustomed to being alone with our new baby during the day. And that was very hard for her. I'm fortunate enough to be able to live close enough home to my home from work.
Yeah.
From home during the day. But again, I am in complete agreement that we need more parental leave for both partners to bond with our baby and mm-hmm. to kind of bring a new child into the world.
Well, so Samantha, thank you so much for your call. So Katie Turr, you heard a couple of stories there. Samantha only getting 2 weeks off after her partner had their baby and 1 week in the hospital of those two weeks.
But I was struck by how she said, we're 1 week to get into a schedule. There's no schedule when you have a newborn. It's just full on 24/7. The idea that you can just take a week and get it going and then leave the mom alone is just laughable.
Yeah. So let me just get another voice in here. I'd like to introduce into the conversation Dr. Kimberly Montez. She joins us from Winston-Salem, North Carolina. She's a pediatrician practicing in Winston-Salem. She also had quite an interesting experience herself as a new mother and a doctor as well. Dr. Montez, welcome to you.
Hi, Magda. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. I understand that you went back to work 1 week after your baby was born, even though your baby was in the NICU for a while. Is that right?
That's correct. I was actually hospitalized a week before giving birth, and my daughter arrived 3 months early, and she had a number of health complications that kept her in the neonatal intensive care for 109 days, including difficulty with breathing and eventually needing a tube to go from the outside of her body to her stomach so that we could feed her through that. And as a mom, as for any mom, it's excruciating to have to go through that as your child fights for her life. But I unfortunately needed to return back to work fairly soon after giving birth so that I could have time to see my daughter. And it was difficult to leave her every day at the hospital when really all I wanted to do was breastfeed her and hold her skin to skin and kiss her and sing to her and read to her every day. Yeah. And as a pediatrician, I know the evidence that supports multiple benefits of paid family leave on maternal and child health.
Do you mind if I ask why you had to go back to work 1 week after this?
Sure. So at the time, I, as many people have, the Family and Medical Leave Act, which does allow 12 weeks of protected work, but it doesn't provide pay. And so unfortunately for my family's economic situation, I needed to return to work, especially given that one of the weeks of my leave was taken from me being in the hospital prior to giving birth. And I think many families similar to mine have to make these excruciating decisions that they have to choose to leave their, unfortunately, leave their child at in the hospital because of not being able to afford their family situation.
Okay, so here's the heart of the matter, right? I mean, Dr. Montez, I very much appreciate you being candid with us about this because you're right, FMLA does allow for some protection of a person's job, but it doesn't guarantee pay. And there are millions of families, millions of new parents who basically are living paycheck to paycheck and cannot go unpaid. So here's what I'm curious. I want to ask both of you, Dr. Montez and Katie as well. There are at least three or four, as far as I can see, proposals on Capitol Hill right now. We touched on Marco Rubio's proposal about sort of taking some Social Security early to help pay for parental leave and then working later when you reach retirement. There's a Democratic proposal for a form of a payroll tax. There's another proposal to use childhood credits as well. It doesn't seem to me, Dr. Montez, that we have a consensus on how to pay for this or whether even it should be paid for. I'm just wondering what your thought is on that, that here we are in 2019 and this is still a really big struggle because the costs are seen as very high.
Look, there are many options to fund a federal program, as you mentioned, and I'm confident that both sides can come together to find a bipartisan policy solution for this very important issue. But really what's most important to remember is that a paid family leave policy has the potential to save lives. In fact, a recent study in North Carolina showed that enacting paid leave on the state level would save 26 infant lives per year. That's incredible. And when you think about that, I mean, lives, there's no number that you can put to an infant life. And I really do think that, both sides can come together to find a solution to pay for this.
Yeah. Well, Katie, I mean, none of the solutions that I just, sort of did the bullet list on, I don't think any of them actually has a majority support amongst Americans, let alone the politicians who might try to pass them.
I think there has to be leadership on this issue, and I do think we're in a unique moment. Look, the Trump administration was able to pass criminal justice reform. That's something that nobody expected. A Republican and Democratic divided Congress to come together with a Republican in the White House and pass. Ivanka Trump has made it her pet issue. I think that if the administration really wanted to push something on this and find a consensus, I do think that they would be able to find it among Republicans and Democrats. There are a number of options out there. There are critiques of each of those options, but there's a lot of room for discussion, and I think there's a lot of room for negotiation.
Yeah, and I want to provide a clarification here because I mentioned the Family and Medical Leave Act. That doesn't apply to people who work in businesses with 50 or fewer employees, so that's a huge swath of Americans as well. Dr. Montez, let me turn back to you here. Can you just outline to us a couple of the medical reasons why paid parental leave is important for families in their earliest stages?
Sure. The American Academy of Pediatrics supports 12 weeks of paid leave so employees can care for themselves and their families. Access to paid family leave benefits everyone, and research demonstrates that parents who have paid leave following the birth of the child, mothers are able to breastfeed for longer, they have lower rates of postpartum depression, parents are more likely to take their children for immunizations and well child care, and paid family leave also enables fathers to take a more hands-on active role, resulting in better cognitive testing during the early years. The first weeks and months of the child's life are absolutely critical to development. So I just can't tell you enough about all of the benefits that relate to child and maternal health.
Yeah.
But there are also benefits, Meghna, if you don't mind me interrupting.
Please go ahead.
Benefits for the businesses and for the economy as well. I know that there's talk about the burden that it might cause businesses if it becomes a tax that goes on both the individual and the business. But it is offset, studies have shown, where this has been enacted by the retention of the employee and the productivity of that employee when they return. Instead of having to find somebody else and retrain them for that job, find somebody who might not be as qualified or might not have had the experience in that job beforehand, you're retaining that employee.
Mm. Katie, did you hear from, sorry, Dr. Montez, let me just ask Katie a quick question here. Did you hear from any people after you spoke out saying, I am not going to have children myself. I don't want to have to pay. I don't think it's fair to have to pay for other people's decision to have children.
I think people have are saying that a lot more, especially among I'm just barely a millennial. I was born in 1983. And among people who are my age and younger, I do hear a lot about how it's just not something that they can afford. Can't afford a house, can't afford to have a kid. They're not making enough money. They don't have any paid family leave. And then when you have a child, having to find child care for that child can bankrupt you as well. The money and the system is not in place in order for them to think that they can have a stable family going forward. I have a friend who moved here from Sweden, and we were having a long discussion about this. Her little sister or a little brother just had a baby, and they get, you know, paid family leave. They get government subsidized or paid for childcare. They make it easy to have a family in Sweden. And she was talking about how she can't imagine what it must be like to have a kid here and how difficult it would be for her.
I guess, Katie, I wasn't very clear before. What I was wondering is, did you hear from people who say, I'm choosing to not have children, and therefore I do not want to have to pay for someone else to take parental
leave? Oh, I'm so sorry.
Yeah, no, that's okay.
Yeah, I've heard from some of those people on Twitter, some of those people who say, and I've also heard from people who've had children on Twitter who say, I don't want to have to pay for your kids. You shouldn't ask everybody else to pay for something that should be your responsibility. And there is that mentality in this country that what's mine is mine and what's yours is yours. And you pay for your own decisions. And I would counter that by saying you're going to be paying for it one way or the other down the line through unstable families. Society benefits from having healthy, happy babies, healthy, happy, stable families. Mm-hmm. And it might not be clear how you will pay for it later on. But if the society isn't working, if there's more trips to the ER, if there's a higher infant mortality rate, if there's more of a problem with mental care in this country, you will be paying for it just in a different and indirect way.
Dr. Montez, I'm sorry that I cut you off earlier, but go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay. I mean, I agree with everything that, you know, Katie is saying. And essentially what it boils down to is virtually every working person, whether they will become a mother or a father, they will need time away from their job at some point to care for either a new child or to deal with serious personal or family health issues. And that's just the fact of the matter, is that this will affect everybody. And Katie is right. You know, the lack of paid leave has many additional economic consequences that are more long-term in nature. You know, studies have shown that low-income kids who succeed academically if they have better childhood programs. And then I just wanted to go back to your question about, you know, there's a lot of claims that paid leave is harmful to businesses or that it costs too much, but there's a lot of research out there on the existing state programs, of which there are 8 currently, plus D.C., who have paid family leave programs. And there's a lot of research that it can benefit both the employees and the employer. So, for example, in California, 87% of companies reported no increased costs as a result of employees utilizing the state's paid family leave and medical leave program. And as Katie mentioned, there are lots of benefits, reducing employee turnover, increasing labor force participation, increasing companies' ability to attract talented workers. So I really think there are lots of economic benefits related to this. And also for women, unfortunately, the caregiving falls disproportionately on women, and the ability to find affordable child care or even get paid time off, it ends up holding back the professional advancement of many women, and it reduces not just family incomes but also economic growth.
I think your state-by-state example, though, is exactly one of the reasons why there's a potent political view that says the answer should come state-by-state and not from the federal level. But before we run out of too much time, let's go to Andrew, who's calling from Blue Hill, Maine. Andrew, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to mention I'm a carpenter, so not really high income. Self-employed, so we don't really have insurance. We have 3 children, and my wife stays at home, and every time we've had a child, I've taken at least 1 or 2 weeks off. And if I can do it, and I have to drive a little bit less fancy vehicle, or maybe I can't go out to eat all the time with my friends, if I can do it, I don't see why everybody else couldn't just. I mean, you have like 8 or 9 months you could plan, save up a few paychecks, and we don't have to have government intervention. And, I mean, they already spend way too much money. So I don't see how we need more involvement when it's a personal choice.
Andrew, I'm going to take it back from you there just because we have about only a minute left before we have to take a break. But thank you for your call. Katie Turr, there it is. I mean, Andrew's saying like he's made that life choice. His family's made that life choice. So they should take responsibility for it.
I think Andrew is in a unique position as well. I think he can afford to save up. There are not a lot of families. There are a lot of families out there who cannot afford to save up, who are living paycheck to paycheck, and there's no pinching and scrimping, and there's no extra money that they can put aside to make it work.
Well, you know, we are in a situation, though, where we have the CRADLE Act, the New Parents Act, the Family Act, the Working Parents Flexibility Act, some launched by Republicans, some by Democrats. There's a proposal for it in the president's 2020 budget. So maybe this might be the year that something comes forward. Dr. Montez, we have just about 20 seconds left. I wonder if you have a last thought for folks on paid parental leave in the United States.
Sure. I think policymakers have a really important role to play in this national discussion. And I think stakeholders, such as myself, we can engage with policymakers, we can advocate on behalf of children and families, and we can really help develop meaningful public policy on paid family leave, which is really for the good of our nation's children and our future children.
Well, Dr. Kimberly Montez is a pediatrician practicing in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Dr. Montez, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
And Katie Turr, MSNBC anchor and NBC News correspondent with us from New York. Katie, thank you so much for sharing your story and for putting this issue once again back in the forefront of our minds. Thank you so much, Katie.
Thank you for having me.
When we come back, we'll talk with Mark Sanford and his bid for the Republican nomination to the White House. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, the Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, On Point listeners. I'm poet and author Shinyi Pai. As you celebrate Asian American Pacific Islander Heritage Month, I invite you to listen to the 10,000 Things podcast from KUOW and the NPR Network. 10,000 Things is a podcast about modern artifacts of Asian American life, ordinary objects that tell extraordinary stories and reveal something profound about the experience of being Asian in America. Find 10,000 Things from KUOW and the NPR Network, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Mark Sanford joins us now. He's the former Republican governor of South Carolina, and he's now one of three people running against President Donald Trump in the GOP 2020 primaries. While Sanford says his bid is really a fight for the soul of the Republican Party, the party itself is pushing back, making it challenging, if not impossible, for Trump's challengers to make it onto the ballot in several states. And we want to hear from you. What is your question for Mark Sanford as he launches a presidential run against President Donald Trump? And Mark Sanford joins us now from Charleston, South Carolina. Governor Sanford, welcome to On Point.
It's nice to hear your voice. Pleasure.
It's good to have you, Governor. So first of all, let our listeners know, why is it that you're running against President Trump in the Republican primaries for 2020?
Because I think he's taking us in the wrong direction. I think we need to have a serious conversation as Republicans about what it means to be a Republican, because I think we've lost our way in a whole series of different things. I'd begin first with the way in which we're spending money. That was historically a linchpin to what the Republican Party was allegedly about, the idea of financial conservatism. And I'd go from there all the way to tone, which I think is misplaced these days coming out of the White House.
Do you think the Republican Party has become a cult of personality around Donald Trump?
Too much so, yes. I mean, ideally, whether you're a Republican, Democrat, Independent, you have a set of ideas and ideals that drive your political agenda. What's interesting, I'm a very conservative Republican. I voted with the administration overwhelmingly, and yet only in this moment in time that we're in right now is that enough, because the president ended up viewing me as an enemy, as an opponent. I mean, I love my brothers and sisters, but I don't agree with them all the time. And yet we still have a relationship. We carve things out. We do things. That's the way it ought to work. Politics ought to be about ideas. And what it is on all too many days seemingly out of the White House is, are you for me or against me as a person? He wants personal loyalty as opposed to ideal loyalty.
Hmm. But it seems as if, you know, the movers and shakers, the power brokers in the Republican Party, don't disagree with the president. I mean, Arizona, Kansas, Nevada, South Carolina, your home state, have canceled their nominating primaries. Or
and
their
contests. But I would see that as a sign of weakness. I mean, South Carolina happens to be the first in the South Republican primary. It's historically had that spot. It's given South Carolinians at times disproportionate influence in the national debate. And in the world of politics, if you have the chance to lock in a 90% win, which is what he alleges his support numbers are, then you take it. You take it all day long, particularly if it's the first in the South primary, given its implication in other primaries that will follow. But what they did in this instance was to say, no, let's cancel it, which is to say many people back here at home are saying it must mean his support is a mile wide but an inch deep.
Hmm. Now, Governor, if I may ask, actually, you know what? I'm going to go to our callers and let them ask. We are talking with former South Carolina Governor Mark Sanford. He is one of three Republicans who are running against President Donald Trump in the GOP primaries for the 2020 presidential race. So let's go to Candy, who's calling from Sarasota, Florida. Candy, you're on the air. What's your question for Governor Sanford?
Hi. I've been doing a little research on you since you've come through for the primary, and, you know, you've been ranked pretty badly as a governor, and you've been shown to be very fiscally conservative. So what would convince me or any other, you know, any other voter to vote for you, not just in a primary, but as president in general? Because, you know, even if you get past the primary, we have to decide that we want you as our president. What would bring us to your side?
Well, I think of, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder in the world of politics. So to Candy's point, depending on your political perspective, I'd be great or I'd be horrible. The Cato Institute rated me as the most financially conservative governor in the United States of America. When I was in Congress, I was rated similarly by the National Taxpayers Union, Citizens Against Government Waste, groups like that. And so I think what would matter is, does the issue set of the debt and deficit and how much we're spending as a country matter to you? I think it should. If you look at the numbers, you know, we will spend more on interest next year than we do on all programs on behalf of children in the United States of America. If you're a defense hawk, you'd say, well, maybe I do care about this because we'll spend more on interest than we will on national defense in just 36 months. I would also say this, not just am I a financial conservative, but I was actually endorsed by the Sierra Club, which is, I mean, frankly, very odd. It doesn't happen a lot with the Republican governors, but in my second term, because I was very involved in environmental and conservation issues, because I think the conservatism means Teddy Roosevelt kind of conservatism as it relates to natural resources and those sorts of things. I, you know, worked with Democrats on civil liberty issues. I mean, so I think you'd have to dig into the issues that are important to you. And I think I have a common sense perspective that has resulted, at least during the two terms of my governorship, in results that mattered to people's lives and impacted their lives in a beneficial way.
Hmm. Now, Governor Sanford, I wonder if you think you're the best person to put forth this message about the need for a vigorous primary in the Republican Party. Because, look, as you know, for a lot of people outside of South Carolina, maybe one of the first times they heard about you is regarding one of the reasons why you had to leave the governorship of South Carolina when you were you had a an extramarital relationship with an Argentinian woman, and then you ran for Congress and won once, and then didn't and then failed to win re-election. Something which
wait. We got a couple of different urban legends in there, both of which are false.
Okay,
so one, I never left the governorship. I served out my term. So there's an urban legend that I was forced out or left. That's not true. So Google me, and you'll find that what you're just saying there is not true. I served out my second term as governor. And then I actually was elected to Congress again, but it's not true that I was there just one term. Again, Google it, and what you'll find was that I was there for three terms, and not until I win it against Donald Trump rather vociferously during our 2 years of overlap that he came out against me. He endorsed my primary opponent, and that was the end of my time in politics. What is true about what you said was I did have an extramarital affair, and it proved incredibly costly. But unlike Donald Trump, who said there's nothing for which he's apologetic or sorry for, during my last year and a half of the governorship, I went on something of an apology tour. And, you know, I people were finally like, shut up, we got it, Mark. But I think it was very important. And I think in the wake of public failure, you can learn a level of humility and empathy toward others that you don't have when you've only seen success in life. And so I went through a rather public failure. But it's something that is an amazing personal journey to go on back here at home, wherein people who know you best in the wake of all that say, look, we know you, we trust you, we don't approve of how you handle that particular chapter of life. But because we know you and trust you, we will actually send you back to be our emissary to Washington. We will send you back to the United States Congress. That's a rather humbling journey to go on. And so what I would say to folks, by all means, that's a part of my history, but we all have history. And the question is, do you learn from the mistakes of your life, or are you blatantly unapologetic about mistakes as the president is? And so I'd say, I guess I'd boil it down this way. I'd ask that people not judge me on the worst day or chapter of my life any more than I'd ask to judge me on my best day. Look at the totality of my time in politics and the totality of my life and make a judgment on that.
Okay, let's go to Aaron, who's calling from Albuquerque, New Mexico. Aaron, you're on the air.
So my question is, as an independent voter such as myself, when I see the Republicans suppressing a democratic process in four states by not allowing a primary, and I see a lack of willingness to be transparent with a lot of the governmental criticisms that are occurring with the with the Republican Party, what message are the Republicans sending to independents such as myself who cannot vote in a primary but will vote in a general?
A horrible one. I mean, you know, in some countries they have coronations, other countries they have coup d'etats, in other countries they got fixed or rigged elections. I mean, our tradition, this country, is open, robust debates and the elections that go with them. And that's what's so crazy about, you know, them shutting down a election here in South Carolina. You got a former two-term governor, somebody spent 25 years in politics, you know, 12 years in the House of Representatives, who knows a lot of people and therefore the building blocks of political movements, somebody who set up a number of successful political campaigns in this state. And they say, well, we don't want to risk it. We're going to actually end that election. I think it's anti-democratic. I think it's a mistake. And yet it is what it is. I held a series of press conferences yesterday across the state with a cardboard cutout of Donald Trump saying this is wrong. This shouldn't be the only debate that we have here in cardboard form.
Governor Sanford, a couple of minutes ago, you said, yes, you think that the Republican Party is becoming too much a cult of personality around Donald Trump. I mean, if that's the case, why do you stay in the party? Why are you still a Republican?
Because, the old saying is, do you want to stay in the family and try and change it, or do you, you know, move on? And I think that wherever possible, we ought to stay in the groups, the associations that, you know, maybe were formative in our lives, maybe something in which we invested a lot of time and energy in. I've invested 25 years of my life in the political process through the vehicle of the Republican Party. Oftentimes I was considered a libertarian or an independent. I wasn't, quote, enough of a Republican in South Carolina, but that didn't keep me from finding electoral success in South Carolina. So I think that we ought to have a robust debate of whether or not we are the party of Lincoln with regard to inclusion and equality. Are we the party of Teddy Roosevelt with regard to, foreign policy or the environment? Are we the party of Reagan with regard to a sunnier disposition and certainly being a happy warrior? You can have political opponents, but that didn't make them your enemies. Mm. I think that was more Reagan's public approach, and I think it would be... So I think that there's a strong legacy there within Republicans in doing good things. I mean, Eisenhower began the interstate system and had, I think, a robust view toward foreign policy engagements and reservations about the military-industrial complex. So I think that there's a lot to build on.
Right.
And I think we ought to have a course correction, go back to some of the fundamentals that made the party viable and strong in the first place, so that we can have a healthy two-party system. Right now, we have Democrats who are having a healthy and robust debate on their side, but we're simply circling the wagons on the Republican side and not having concurrent debate about what it means to be a Republican.
Governor Sanford, let me play something for you here. This was during one of your appearances on MSNBC with Chris Matthews on August 12th. This is just before you officially announced that you'd be challenging the president in the GOP primaries. And here's the interaction you had with Chris Matthews.
Yeah. Let's talk about November 2020, when you'd like to be on the Republican ticket as president. Suppose the ticket is instead led by the president, current president, and also the choice is, say, somebody like Joe Biden, a moderate Democrat. Who would you vote for right now? Trump or Biden? Who'd you vote for?
Again, I am a Republican. I mean, there's no getting around
but who
that.
Would have you, so, who would again, you vote I'd, for? You're out there to knock Trump I, off. Would you vote for him if you
I
had to?
I believe in the sanctity of the ballot box, Chris. And so I think it's not going to be Bernie Sanders. It's not going to be Elizabeth Warren. It's not going to be a variety of different folks. I think it would be President Trump, but I would want to look at that election at that time based on the issues that are at play.
You go Trump over Biden?
I would.
Governor Sanford, that was you on August 12th. So let me ask you now, if President Trump is the Republican nominee in 2020, will you vote for him?
I'll say exactly what I said back on August 12th or 20th or whatever the date was, which is I'll look at it at that time. I mean, I believe in issues. I think we all ought to believe in issues. And there shouldn't be, just because I'm a Republican, just because I'm a Democrat, I'm going to vote Democrat. I'm going to vote for the person who more closely aligns with me on the debt deficit government spending issue.
But Governor, if I just may jump in here. No, I just want to jump in for a second here because you ended that interaction with Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews said, would you go Trump over Biden? And you paused and you said, I would. So my question for you is, if you think that the Republican Party is headed in veering off in the wrong direction so strongly, the direction of Donald Trump, when it comes to actually exercising your vote, why would you vote for him? I mean, you didn't even say, I just wouldn't cast a vote. You said, I would vote for Donald Trump. That's effectively giving him your support, your endorsement.
Well, the question was set up as a binary choice, A or B. It wasn't C. It was, would you vote for X or would you vote for Y? So I was trying to answer the question as it was framed.
Is there another Democrat that running that you would instead feel more confident supporting over President Trump?
I think the complexity of the question is this. What I hear from my Democratic friends is that Biden ultimately won't be the person standing. It's more likely going to be Warren or Bernie. That's what they tell me. Who knows? There's a long time to go between here and there. I think that it would be difficult for me to vote for, let's say, Bernie Sanders, simply because of the number of different costly proposals that he's laid out without a concurrent pay for. And then you go into the question of engagement with the rest of the world, institutions, tone, all those different things. But I would say that the center of the bullseye for me as it relates to issues is the way in which we're headed toward a financial hurricane. Nobody's talking about it on the Republican or the Democratic side. And I think that issue needs to be elevated. I'm trying to do that. And then if somebody's asking me, who would I vote for, it'd be the person closest to dealing with that financial hurricane that is, I believe, coming our way.
Well, Mark Sanford is the former governor of the state of South Carolina with us today from Charleston, South Carolina. He is running against President Donald Trump, one of three people running against the president in the GOP primaries for 2020. Governor Sanford, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from BU Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes.
Can Profit Motive Save the Planet is a company that takes the climate into account a better investment? How about one that pays workers a living wage and champions transparency and board diversity? That's the idea of ESG, or environmental social governance.
Sounds like a wonderful story. You can make more money, you can save the planet at the same time. Almost no one is going to turn that down.
It's a story that Andy King of Questrom and Veet Henish of the Wharton School challenged during a recent event at Questrom. Professor King played the critic, who says these are problems for regulation to solve, not markets.
As a famous economist said to me, you can't fix externalities with the profit motive, because the profit motive is not linked to externalities. Externalities are the byproduct of pursuing profits. So you can't fix them by getting people to even look harder at profits.
Meanwhile, Veet emphasized that ESG can be an important part of the solution.
Regulation matters, and we need better regulation. And we need to reallocate trillions of dollars of capital over time to the climate transition alone, forgetting social justice, racial justice, and other ESG issues. We're going to need the profit motive for that. No government regulation is going to reallocate tens of trillions of dollars of capital alone. It's going to be investors who are looking at current government regulation and future government regulation and trying to connect the dots.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.